Side 5, The Catcher in the Rye by J.D. Salinger. Continuing on page 232.
If you go away, you won't see me in the play, she said.
Her voice sounded funny when she said it.
Yes, I will. I won't go away before that. I think I want to miss the play, I said. What I'll do, I'll probably stay at Mr. Antolini's house till maybe Tuesday night. Then I'll come home. If I get a chance, I'll phone you. Here, old Phoebe said.
She was trying to give me the dough, but she couldn't find my hand.
Where?
She put the dough in my hand.
Hey, I don't need all this, I said. Just give me $2 is all. No kidding. Here.
I tried to give it back to her, but she wouldn't take it.
You can take it all. You can pay me back. Bring it to the play. How much is it, for God's sake? $8.85. 65 cents. I spent some.
Then, all of a sudden, I started to cry. I couldn't help it. I did it so nobody could hear me, but I did it. It scared hell out of old Phoebe when I started doing it, and she came over and tried to make me stop. But once you get started, you can't just stop on a goddamn dime. I was still sitting on the edge of the bed when I did it. Then she put her old arm around my neck, and I put my arm around her, too. But I still couldn't stop for a long time. I thought I was going to choke to death or something. Boy, I scared hell out of poor old Phoebe. The damn window was open and everything, and I could feel her shivering and all, because all she had on was her pajamas. I tried to make her get back in bed, but she wouldn't go. Finally, I stopped. But it certainly took me a long, long time. Then I finished buttoning my coat and all. I told her I'd keep in touch with her. She told me I could sleep with her if I wanted to, but I said no, that I'd better beat it, that Mr. Antolini was waiting for me and all. Then I took my hunting hat out of my coat pocket and gave it to her. She likes those kind of crazy hats. She didn't want to take it, but I made her. I'll bet she slept with it on. She really likes those kind of hats. Then I told her again I'd give her a buzz if I got a chance, and then I left. It was a hell of a lot easier getting out of the house than it was getting in, for some reason. For one thing, I didn't give much of a damn anymore if they caught me. I really didn't. I figured if they caught me, they caught me. I almost wished they did, in a way. I walked all the way downstairs instead of taking the elevator. I went down the back stairs. I nearly broke my neck on about 10 million garbage pails, but I got out all right. The elevator boy didn't even see me. He probably still thinks I'm up at the Dick Steins.
24.
Mr. and Mrs. Antolini had this very swanky apartment over on Sutton Place, with two steps that you go down to get in the living room and a bar and all. I'd been there quite a few times, because after I left Elkton Hills, Mr. Antolini came up to our house for dinner quite frequently to find out how I was getting along. He wasn't married then. Then, when he got married, I used to play tennis with he and Mrs. Antolini quite frequently out at the West Side Tennis Club in Forest Hills, Long Island. Mrs. Antolini belonged there. She was lousy with dough. She was about 60 years older than Mr. Antolini, but they seemed to get along quite well. For one thing, they were both very intellectual, especially Mr. Antolini, except that he was more witty than intellectual when you were with him, sort of like D.B. Mrs. Antolini was mostly serious. She had asthma pretty bad. They both read all D.B.'s stories, Mrs. Antolini too, and when D.B. went to Hollywood, Mr. Antolini phoned him up and told him not to go. He went anyway, though. Mr. Antolini said that anybody that could write like D.B. had no business going out to Hollywood. That's exactly what I said, practically. I would have walked down to their house, because I didn't want to spend any of Phoebe's Christmas dough that I didn't have to, but I felt funny when I got outside, sort of dizzy, so I took a cab. I didn't want to, but I did. I had a hell of a time even finding a cab. Old Mr. Antolini answered the door when I rang the bell. After the elevator boy finally let me up, the bastard. He had on his bathrobe and slippers, and he had a highball in one hand. He was a pretty sophisticated guy, and he was a pretty heavy drinker. Holden, my boy, he said. My God, he's grown another 20 inches. Fine to see you. How are you, Mr. Antolini? How's Mrs. Antolini? We're both just dandy. Let's have that coat. He took my coat off me and hung it up. I expected to see a day-old infant in your arms. Nowhere to turn. Snowflakes in your eyelashes. He's a very witty guy sometimes. He turned around and yelled out to the kitchen, Lillian, how's the coffee coming? Lillian was Mrs. Antolini's first name. It's all ready, she yelled back. Is that Holden? Hello, Holden. Hello, Mrs. Antolini. You were always yelling when you were there. That's because the both of them were never in the same room at the same time. It was sort of funny. Sit down, Holden, Mr. Antolini said. You could tell he was a little oiled up. The room looked like they'd just had a party. Glasses were all over the place and dishes with peanuts in them. Excuse the appearance of the place, he said. We've been entertaining some buffalo friends of Mrs. Antolini's. Some buffaloes, as a matter of fact. I laughed, and Mrs. Antolini yelled something into me from the kitchen, but I couldn't hear her. What'd she say? I asked Mr. Antolini. She said not to look at her when she comes in. She just arose from the sack. Have a cigarette. Are you smoking now? Thanks, I said. I took a cigarette from this box he offered me. Just once in a while. I'm a moderate smoker. I'll bet you are, he said. He gave me a light from this big lighter off the table. So, you and Pensy are no longer one, he said. He always said things that way. Sometimes it amused me a lot, and sometimes it didn't. He sort of did it a little bit too much. I don't mean he wasn't witty or anything. He was. But sometimes it gets on your nerves when somebody's always saying things like, so you and Pensy are no longer one. G.B. does it too much sometimes, too. What was the trouble? Mr. Antolini asked me. How'd you do in English? I'll show you the door in short order if you flunked English, you little ace composition writer. Oh, I passed English all right. It was mostly literature, though. I only wrote about 2 compositions the whole term, I said. I flunked oral expression, though. They had this course you had to take, oral expression. That I flunked. Why? I don't know. I didn't feel much like going into it. I was still feeling sort of dizzy or something, and I had a hell of a headache all of a sudden. I really did. But you could tell he was interested, so I told him a little bit about it. It's this course where each boy in class has to get up in class and make a speech. You know, spontaneous and all. And if the boy digresses at all, you're supposed to yell digression at him as fast as you can. It just about drove me crazy. I got an F in it. Why? Oh, I don't know. That digression business got on my nerves. I don't know. The trouble with me is I like it when somebody digresses. It's more interesting and all. You don't care to have somebody stick to the point when he tells you something? Oh, sure, I like somebody to stick to the point and all, but I don't like them to stick too much to the point. I don't know. I guess I don't like it when somebody sticks to the point all the time. The boys that got the best marks in oral expression were the ones that stuck to the point all the time, I admit it. But there was this one boy, Richard Kinsella. He didn't stick to the point too much, and they were always yelling digression at him. It was terrible, because in the first place, he was a very nervous guy. I mean, he was a very nervous guy, and his lips were always shaking whenever it was his time to make a speech, and you could hardly hear him if he was sitting way in the back of the room. When his lips sort of quit shaking a little bit, though, I liked his speeches better than anybody else's. He practically flunked the course, though, too. He got a D+. Because they kept yelling digression at him all the time. For instance, he made this speech about this farm his father bought in Vermont. They kept yelling digression at him the whole time he was making it, and this teacher, Mr. Vinson, gave him an F on it because he hadn't told what kind of animals and vegetables and stuff grew on the farm and all. What he did was, Richard Kinsella, he'd start telling you all about that stuff, Then all of a sudden, he'd start telling you about this letter his mother got from his uncle, and how his uncle got polio and all when he was 42 years old, and how he wouldn't let anybody come to see him in the hospital because he didn't want anybody to see him with a brace on. It didn't have much to do with the farm, I admit it, but it was nice. It's nice when somebody tells you about their uncle, especially when they start out telling you about their father's farm, and then all of a sudden get more interested in their uncle. I mean, it's dirty to keep yelling digression at him when he's all nice and excited. I don't know, it's hard to explain. I didn't feel too much like trying, either. For one thing, I had this terrific headache all of a sudden. I wish to God old Mrs. Antolini would come in with the coffee. That's something that annoys hell out of me. I mean, if somebody says the coffee's all ready and it isn't.
Holden, one short, faintly stuffy, pedagogical question. Don't you think there's a time and place for everything? Don't you think if someone starts out to tell you about his father's farm, he should stick to his guns, then get around to telling you about his uncle's brace? Or, if his uncle's brace is such a provocative subject, shouldn't he have selected it in the first place as his subject, not the farm? I didn't feel much like thinking and answering and all. I had a headache, and I felt lousy. I even had sort of a stomach ache, if you want to know the truth. Yes, I don't know. I guess he should. I mean, I guess he should have picked his uncle as a subject instead of the farm, if that interested him most. But what I mean is, lots of time, you don't know what interests you most till you start talking about something that doesn't interest you most. I mean, you can't help it sometimes. What I think is, you're supposed to leave somebody alone if he's at least being interesting and he's getting all excited about something. I like it when somebody gets excited about something. It's nice. You just didn't know this teacher, Mr. Vincent. He could drive you crazy sometimes, him and the goddamn class. I mean, he'd keep telling you to unify and simplify all the time. Some things you just can't do that to. I mean, you can't hardly ever simplify and unify something just because somebody wants you to. You didn't know this guy, Mr. Vincent. I mean, he was very intelligent and all, but you could tell he didn't have too much brains. "Coffee, gentlemen, finally," Mrs. Antolini said. She came in carrying this tray with coffee and cakes and stuff on it. "Holden, don't you even peek at me, I'm a mess." "Hello, Mrs. Antolini," I said. I started to get up and all, but Mr. Antolini got hold of my jacket and pulled me back down. Old Mrs. Antolini's hair was full of those iron curler jobs, and she didn't have any lipstick or anything on. She didn't look too gorgeous. She looked pretty old and all. "I'll leave this right here. Just dive in, you two," she said. She put the tray down on the cigarette table, pushing all these glasses out of the way. "How's your mother, Holden?" "She's fine, thanks. I haven't seen her too recently. But the last I..." "Darling, if Holden needs anything, everything's in the linen closet, the top shelf. I'm going to bed. I'm exhausted," Mrs. Antolini said. She looked it, too. "Can you boys make up the couch by yourselves?" "We'll take care of everything. You run along to bed," Mr. Antolini said. He gave Mrs. Antolini a kiss, and she said goodbye to me and went in the bedroom. They were always kissing each other a lot in public. I had part of a cup of coffee and about half of some cake that was about as hard as a rock. All old Mr. Antolini had was another highball, though. He makes them very strong, too, you could tell. He may get to be an alcoholic if he doesn't watch his step. "I had lunch with your dad a couple of weeks ago," he said all of a sudden. "Did you know that?"
"No, I didn't."
"You're aware, of course, that he's terribly concerned about you."
"I know it. I know he is," I said.
"Apparently, before he phoned me, he'd just had a long, rather harrowing letter from your latest headmaster, to the effect that you were making absolutely no effort at all, cutting classes, coming unprepared to all your classes, in general, being an all-around..."
"I didn't cut any classes. You weren't allowed to cut any.
There were a couple of them I didn't attend once in a while, like that oral expression I told you about, but I didn't cut any."
I didn't feel at all like discussing it. The coffee made my stomach feel a little better, but I still had this awful headache. Mr. Antolini lit another cigarette. He smoked like a fiend. Then he said, "Frankly, I don't know what the hell to say to you, Holden." "I know, I'm very hard to talk to. I realize that. I have a feeling that you're riding for some kind of a terrible, terrible fall. But I don't honestly know what kind." "Are you listening to me?"
"Yes."
You could tell he was trying to concentrate and all. "It may be the kind where at the age of 30 you sit in some bar, hating everybody who comes in, looking as if he might have played football in college. Then again, you may pick up just enough education to hate people who say it's a secret between he and I. Or you may end up in some business office throwing paperclips at the nearest stenographer. I just don't know. But do you know what I'm driving at all?"
"Yes, sure," I said. I did, too.
"But you're wrong about that hating business. I mean about hating football players and all. You really are. I don't hate too many guys. What I may do, I may hate them for a little while, like this guy Stradlater I knew at Pensy and this other boy Robert Ackley. I hated them once in a while, I admit it, but it doesn't last too long is what I mean. After a while, if I didn't see them, if they didn't come in the room, or if I didn't see them in the dining room for a couple of meals, I sort of missed them. I mean, I sort of missed them." Mr. Antolini didn't say anything for a while. He got up and got another hunk of ice and put it in his drink. Then he sat down again. You could tell he was thinking. I kept wishing, though, that he'd continue the conversation in the morning instead of now, but he was hot. People are mostly hot to have a discussion when you're not. "All right, listen to me a minute now. I may not word this as memorably as I'd like to, but I'll write you a letter about it in a day or two. Then you can get it all straight. But listen now, anyway." He started concentrating again. Then he said, "This fall, I think you're writing for... it's a special kind of fall, a horrible kind. The man falling isn't permitted to feel or hear himself hit bottom. He just keeps falling and falling. The whole arrangement's designed for men who, at some time or other in their lives, were looking for something their own environment couldn't supply them with. Or they thought their own environment couldn't supply them with, so they gave up looking. They gave it up before they ever really even got started. You follow me?"
"Yes, sir."
"Sure?"
"Yes."
He got up and poured some more booze in his glass. Then he sat down again. He didn't say anything for quite a long time. "I don't want to scare you," he said, "but I can very clearly see you dying nobly one way or another for some highly unworthy cause." He gave me a funny look. "If I write something down for you, will you read it carefully and keep it?"
"Yes, sure," I said.
I did, too. I still have the paper he gave me. He went over to this desk on the other side of the room, and without sitting down, wrote something on a piece of paper. Then he came back and sat down with the paper in his hand. Oddly enough, this wasn't written by a practicing poet. It was written by a psychoanalyst named Wilhelm Stekel. Here's what he... "Are you still with me?"
"Yes, sure I am."
"Here's what he said. The mark of the immature man is that he wants to die nobly for a cause, while the mark of the mature man is that he wants to live humbly for one." He leaned over and handed it to me. I read it right when he gave it to me, and then I thanked him and all and put it in my pocket. It was nice of him to go to all that trouble. It really was. The thing was, though, I didn't feel much like concentrating. Boy, I felt so damn tired all of a sudden. You could tell he wasn't tired at all, though. He was pretty oiled up, for one thing. "I think that one of these days," he said, "you're going to have to find out where you want to go. And then you've got to start going there. But immediately. You can't afford to lose a minute. Not you." I nodded, because he was looking right at me and all, but I wasn't too sure what he was talking about.
I was pretty sure I knew, but I wasn't too positive at the time. I was too damn tired. "And I hate to tell you," he said, "but I think that once you have a fair idea where you want to go, your first move will be to apply yourself in school. You'll have to. You're a student, whether the idea appeals to you or not. You're in love with knowledge. And I think you'll find, once you get past all the Mr. Vinces and their oral comp—" "Mr. Vinces," I said. He meant all the Mr. Vinces, not all the Mr. Vinces. I shouldn't have interrupted him, though. "All right, the Mr. Vinces. Once you get past all the Mr. Vinces, you're going to start getting closer and closer, that is, if you want to, and if you look for it and wait for it, to the kind of information that will be very, very dear to your heart. Among other things, you'll find that you're not the first person who was ever confused and frightened and even sickened by human behavior. You're by no means alone on that score. You'll be excited and stimulated to know. Many, many men have been just as troubled morally and spiritually as you are right now. Happily, some of them kept records of their troubles. You'll learn from them, if you want to. Just as some day, if you have something to offer, someone will learn something from you. It's a beautiful reciprocal arrangement. It isn't education. It's history. It's poetry." He stopped and took a big drink out of his highball. Then he started again. Boy, he was really hot. I was glad I didn't try to stop him or anything. "I'm not trying to tell you," he said, "that only educated and scholarly men are able to contribute something valuable to the world. It's not so. But I do say that educated and scholarly men, if they're brilliant and creative to begin with, which unfortunately is rarely the case, tend to leave infinitely more valuable records behind them than men do who are merely brilliant and creative. They tend to express themselves more clearly, and they usually have a passion for following their thoughts through to the end. And, most important, 9 times out of 10, they have more humility than the unscholarly thinker. Do you follow me at all?"
"Yes, sir."
He didn't say anything again for quite a while. I don't know if you've ever done it, but it's sort of hard to sit around waiting for somebody to say something when they're thinking and all. It really is. I kept trying not to yawn. It wasn't that I was bored or anything. I wasn't. But I was so damn sleepy all of a sudden. "Something else an academic education will do for you. If you go along with it any considerable distance, it'll begin to give you an idea what size mind you have, what it'll fit, and maybe what it won't. After a while, you'll have an idea what kind of thoughts your particular size mind should be wearing. For one thing, it may save you an extraordinary amount of time trying on ideas that don't suit you, aren't becoming to you. You'll begin to know your true measurements and dress your mind accordingly." Then, all of a sudden, I yawned. What a rude bastard! But I couldn't help it. Mr. Antolini just laughed, though. "Come on," he said, and got up. "We'll fix up the couch for you." I followed him, and he went over to this closet and tried to take down some sheets and blankets and stuff that was on the top shelf, but he couldn't do it with this highball glass in his hand. So he drank it, and then put the glass down on the floor, and then he took the stuff down. I helped him bring it over to the couch. We both made the bed together. He wasn't too hot at it. He didn't tuck anything in very tight. I didn't care, though. I could have slept standing up. I was so tired. "How are all your women?"
"They're okay."
I was being a lousy conversationalist, but I didn't feel like it. "How's Sally?" He knew old Sally Hayes. I introduced him once. "She's all right. I had a date with her this afternoon." Boy, it seemed like 20 years ago. "We don't have too much in common anymore." "Hell of a pretty girl. What about that other girl, the one you told me about in Maine?"
"Oh, Jane Gallagher. She's all right. I'm probably going to give her a buzz tomorrow."
We were all done making up the couch then.
It's all yours, Mr. Antolini said. I don't know what the hell you're going to do with those legs of yours.
That's all right. I'm used to short beds, I said. Thanks a lot, sir. You and Mrs. Antolini really saved my life tonight.
You know where the bathroom is. If there's anything you want, just holler. I'll be in the kitchen for a while. Will the light bother you?
No, heck no. Thanks a lot.
All right. Good night, handsome.
Good night, sir. Thanks a lot.
He went out in the kitchen, and I went in the bathroom and got undressed and all. I couldn't brush my teeth because I didn't have any toothbrush with me. I didn't have any pajamas either, and Mr. Randolini forgot to lend me some. So I just went back in the living room and turned off this little lamp next to the couch, and then I got in bed with just my shorts on. It was way too short for me, the couch, but I really could have slept standing up without batting an eyelash. I laid awake for just a couple of seconds, thinking about all that stuff Mr. Randolini told me, about finding out the size of your mind and all. He was really a pretty smart guy. But I couldn't keep my goddamn eyes open, and I fell asleep. Then, something happened. I don't even like to talk about it. I woke up all of a sudden. I don't know what time it was or anything, but I woke up. I felt something on my head, some guy's hand. Boy, it really scared hell out of me. What it was Mr. Randolini's hand. What he was doing was, he was sitting on the floor right next to the couch in the dark and all, and he was sort of petting me or patting me on the goddamn head. Boy, I'll bet I jumped about 1,000 feet. What the hell are you doing? I said. Nothing. I'm simply sitting here admiring. What are you doing anyway? I said over again. I didn't know what the hell to say. I mean, I was embarrassed as hell. How about keeping your voice down? I'm simply sitting here. I have to go anyway, I said. Boy, was I nervous. I started putting on my damn pants in the dark. I could hardly get them on, I was so damn nervous. I know more damn perverts at school and all than anybody you ever met, and they're always being perverty when I'm around. You have to go where? Mr. Antolini said. He was trying to act very goddamn casual and cool and all, but he wasn't any too goddamn cool, take my word. I left my bags and all at the station. I think maybe I better go down and get them. I have all my stuff in them. They'll be there in the morning. Now go back to bed. I'm going to bed myself. What's the matter with you? Nothing's the matter. It's just that all my money and stuff's in one of my bags. I'll be right back. I'll get a cab and be right back, I said. Boy, I was falling all over myself in the dark. The thing is, it isn't mine, the money. It's my mother's. And I... Don't be ridiculous, Holden. Get back in that bed. I'm going to bed myself. The money will be there safe and sound in the morning. No! No kidding! I gotta get going. I really do. I was damn near all dressed already, except that I couldn't find my tie. I couldn't remember where I'd put my tie. I put on my jacket and all without it. Old Mr. Randolini was sitting now in the big chair a little ways away from me, watching me. It was dark and all, and I couldn't see him so hot, but I knew he was watching me all right. He was still boozing, too. I could see his trusty highball glass in his hand. You're a very, very strange boy. I know it, I said. I didn't even look around much for my tie, so I went without it. Goodbye, sir, I said. Thanks a lot, no kidding. He kept walking right behind me when I went to the front door, and when I rang the elevator bell, he stayed in the damn doorway. All he said was that business about my being a very, very strange boy again. Strange my ass. Then he waited in the doorway and all till the goddamn elevator came. I never waited so long for an elevator in my whole goddamn life, I swear. I didn't know what the hell to talk about while I was waiting for the elevator, and he kept standing there, so I said, I'm going to start reading some good books. I really am. I mean, you had to say something. It was very embarrassing. You grab your bags and scoot right on back here again. I'll leave the door unlatched. Thanks a lot, I say. Goodbye. The elevator was finally there. I got in and went down. Boy, I was shaking like a madman.
I was sweating, too. When something perverty like that happens, I start sweating like a bastard. That kind of stuff's happened to me about 20 times since I was a kid. I can't stand it. 25. When I got outside, it was just getting light out. It was pretty cold, too, but it felt good because I was sweating so much. I didn't know where the hell to go. I didn't want to go to another hotel and spend all Phoebe's dough. So finally, all I did was, I walked over to Lexington and took the subway down to Grand Central. My bags were there and all, and I figured I'd sleep in that crazy waiting room where all the benches are. So that's what I did. It wasn't too bad for a while, because there weren't many people around and I could stick my feet up. But I don't feel much like discussing it. It wasn't too nice. Don't ever try it. I mean it. It'll depress you. I only slept till around 9 o'clock, because a million people started coming in the waiting room and I had to take my feet down. I can't sleep so hot if I have to keep my feet on the floor. So I sat up. I still had that headache. It was even worse. And I think I was more depressed than I ever was in my whole life. I didn't want to, but I started thinking about old Mr. Antolini, and I wondered what he'd tell Mrs. Antolini when she saw I hadn't slept there or anything. And that part didn't worry me too much, though, because I knew Mr. Antolini was very smart and that he could make up something to tell her. He could tell her I'd gone home or something. That part didn't worry me much. But what did worry me was the part about how I'd woke up and found him patting me on the head and all. I mean, I wondered if just maybe I was wrong about thinking he was making a flitty pass at me. I wondered if maybe he just liked to pat guys on the head when they're asleep. I mean, how can you tell about that stuff for sure? You can't. I even started wondering if maybe I should have got my bags and gone back to his house the way I'd said I would. I mean, I started thinking that even if he was a flit, he certainly had been very nice to me. I thought how he hadn't minded it when I'd called him up so late, and how he'd told me to come right over if I felt like it, and how he went to all that trouble giving me that advice about finding out the size of your mind at all, and how he was the only guy that had even gone near that boy James Castle I told you about when he was dead. I thought about all that stuff, and the more I thought about it, the more depressed I got. I mean, I started thinking maybe I should have gone back to his house. Maybe he was only patting my head just for the hell of it. The more I thought about it, though, the more depressed and screwed up about it I got. What made it even worse, my eyes were sore as hell. They felt all sore and burny from not getting too much sleep. Besides that, I was getting sort of a cold, and I didn't even have a goddamn handkerchief with me. I had some in my suitcase, but I didn't feel like taking it out of that strong box and opening it up right in public and all. There was this magazine that somebody'd left on the bench next to me, so I started reading it, thinking it'd make me stop thinking about Mr. Randolini and a million other things for at least a little while. But this damn article I started reading made me feel almost worse. It was all about hormones. It described how you should look, your face and eyes and all, if your hormones were in good shape, and I didn't look that way at all. I looked exactly like the guy in the article with lousy hormones. So I started getting worried about my hormones. Then I read this other article about how you can tell if you have cancer or not. It said if you had any sores in your mouth that didn't heal pretty quickly, it was a sign that you probably had cancer. I'd had this sore on the inside of my lip for about 2 weeks, so I figured I was getting cancer. That magazine was some little cheer-upper. I finally quit reading it and went outside for a walk. I figured I'd be dead in a couple of months because I had cancer. I really did. I was even positive I would be. It certainly didn't make me feel too gorgeous. It sort of looked like it was going to rain, but I went for this walk anyway. For one thing, I figured I ought to get some breakfast. I wasn't at all hungry, but I figured I ought to at least eat something. I mean, at least get something with some vitamins in it. So I started walking way over east, where the pretty cheap restaurants are, because I didn't want to spend a lot of dough. While I was walking, I passed these two guys that were unloading this big Christmas tree off a truck. One guy kept saying to the other guy, "Hold the son of a bitch up! Hold it up, for Christ's sake!" It certainly was a gorgeous way to talk about a Christmas tree. It was sort of funny, though, in an awful way, and I started to sort of laugh. It was about the worst thing I could have done, because the minute I started to laugh, I thought I was going to vomit. I really did. I even started to, but it went away. I don't know why. I mean, I hadn't eaten anything unsanitary or like that, and usually I have quite a strong stomach. Anyway, I got over it, and I figured I'd feel better if I had something to eat. So I went in this very cheap-looking restaurant and had donuts and coffee. Only I didn't eat the donuts. I couldn't swallow them too well. The thing is, if you get very depressed about something, it's hard as hell to swallow. The waiter was very nice, though. He took them back without charging me. I just drank the coffee. Then I left and started walking over toward Fifth Avenue. It was Monday and all, and pretty near Christmas, and all the stores were open. So it wasn't too bad walking on Fifth Avenue. It was fairly Christmassy. All those scraggy-looking Santa Clauses were standing on corners ringing those bells, and the Salvation Army girls, the ones that don't wear any lipstick or anything, were ringing bells, too. I sort of kept looking around for those two nuns I'd met at breakfast the day before, but I didn't see them. I knew I wouldn't, because they'd told me they'd come to New York to be school teachers, but I kept looking for them anyway. Anyway, it was pretty Christmassy all of a sudden. A million little kids were downtown with their mothers, getting on and off buses and coming in and out of stores. I wished old Phoebe was around. She's not little enough anymore to go stark staring mad in the toy department, but she enjoys horsing around and looking at the people. The Christmas before last, I took her downtown shopping with me. We had a hell of a time. I think it was in Bloomingdale's. We went in the shoe department, and we pretended she, old Phoebe, wanted to get a pair of those very high storm shoes, the kind that have about a million holes to lace up. We had the poor salesman guy going crazy. Old Phoebe tried on about 20 pairs, and each time the poor guy had to lace one shoe all the way up. It was a dirty trick, but it killed old Phoebe. We finally bought a pair of moccasins and charged them. The salesman was very nice about it. I think he knew we were horsing around, because old Phoebe always starts giggling. Anyway, I kept walking and walking up Fifth Avenue without any tie on or anything. Then, all of a sudden, something very spooky started happening. Every time I came to the end of a block and stepped off the goddamn curb, I had this feeling that I'd never get to the other side of the street. I thought I'd just go down, 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 and nobody'd ever see me again. Boy, did it scare me. You can't imagine. I started sweating like a bastard, my whole shirt and underwear and everything. Then I started doing something else. Every time I'd get to the end of a block, I'd make believe I was talking to my brother Allie. I'd say to him, "Allie, don't let me disappear. Allie, don't let me disappear. Allie, don't let me disappear. Please, Allie." And then, when I'd reach the other side of the street without disappearing, I'd thank him. Then it would start all over again as soon as I got to the next corner. But I kept going and all. I was sort of afraid to stop, I think. I don't remember, to tell you the truth. I know I didn't stop until I was way up in the 60s, past the zoo and all. Then I sat down on this bench. I could hardly get my breath, and I was still sweating like a bastard. I sat there, I guess, for about an hour. Finally, what I decided I'd do, I decided I'd go away. I decided I'd never go home again, and I'd never go away to another school again. I decided I'd just see old Phoebe and sort of say goodbye to her and all, and give her back her Christmas dough, and then I'd start hitchhiking my way out west. What I'd do, I figured I'd go down to the Holland Tunnel and bum a ride, and then I'd bum another one, and another one, and another one, and in a few days I'd be somewhere out west where it was very pretty and sunny and where nobody'd know me, and I'd get a job. I figured I could get a job at a filling station somewhere, putting gas and oil in people's cars. I didn't care what kind of a job it was, though, just so people didn't know me and I didn't know anybody. I thought what I'd do was, I'd pretend I was one of those deaf mutes. That way I wouldn't have to have any goddamn stupid useless conversations with anybody. If anybody wanted to tell me something, they'd have to write it on a piece of paper and shove it over to me. They'd get bored as hell doing that after a while, and then I'd be through with having conversations for the rest of my life. Everybody'd think I was just a poor deaf-mute bastard, and they'd leave me alone. They'd let me put gas and oil in their stupid cars, and they'd pay me a salary and all for it, and I'd build me a little cabin somewhere with the dough I made, and live there for the rest of my life. I'd build it right near the woods, but not right in them, because I'd want it to be sunny as hell all the time. I'd cook all my own food, and later on, if I wanted to get married or something, I'd meet this beautiful girl that was also a deaf-mute, and we'd get married. She'd come and live in my cabin with me. And if she wanted to say anything to me, she'd have to write it on a goddamn piece of paper like everybody else. If we had any children, we'd hide them somewhere. We could buy them a lot of books and teach them how to read and write by ourselves. I got excited as hell thinking about it. I really did. I knew the part about pretending I was a deaf mute was crazy, but I liked thinking about it anyway. But I really decided to go out west and all. All I wanted to do first was say goodbye to old Phoebe. So all of a sudden, I ran like a madman across the street. I damn near got killed doing it, if you want to know the truth, and went in the stationery store and bought a pad and pencil. I figured I'd write her a note telling her where to meet me so I could say goodbye to her and give her back her Christmas dough, and then I'd take the note up to her school and get somebody in the principal's office to give it to her. But I just put the pad and pencil in my pocket and started walking fast as hell up to her school. I was too excited to write the note right in the stationery store. I walked fast because I wanted her to get the note before she went home for lunch, and I didn't have any too much time. I knew where her school was, naturally, because I went there myself when I was a kid. When I got there, it felt funny. I wasn't sure I'd remember what it was like inside, but I did. It was exactly the same as it was when I went there. They had that same big yard inside that was always sort of dark, with those cages around the light bulbs so they wouldn't break if they got hit with a ball. They had those same white circles painted all over the floor for games and stuff, and those same old basketball rings without any nets, just the backboards and the rings. Nobody was around at all, probably because it wasn't recess period, and it wasn't lunchtime yet. All I saw was one little kid, a colored kid, on his way to the bathroom. He had one of those wooden passes sticking out of his hip pocket, the same way we used to have, to show he had permission and all to go to the bathroom. I was still sweating, but not so bad anymore. I went over to the stairs and sat down on the first step and took out the pad and pencil I'd bought. The stairs had the same smell they used to have when I went there, like somebody just taken a leak on them. School stairs always smell like that. Anyway, I sat there and wrote this note. Dear Phoebe, I can't wait around till Wednesday anymore, so I will probably hitchhike out west this afternoon. Meet me at the Museum of Art near the door at 12:15 if you can, and I will give you your Christmas dough back. I didn't spend much. Love, Holden. Her school was practically right near the museum, and she had to pass it on her way home for lunch anyway, so I knew she could meet me all right. Then I started walking up the stairs to the principal's office so I could give the note to somebody that would bring it to her in her classroom. I folded it about 10 times so nobody'd open it. You can't trust anybody in a goddamn school. But I knew they'd give it to her if I was her brother-in-law. While I was walking up the stairs, though, all of a sudden, I thought I was going to puke again. Only I didn't. I sat down for a second, and then I felt better. But while I was sitting down, I saw something that drove me crazy. Somebody'd written, "Fuck you," on the wall. It drove me damn near crazy. I thought how Phoebe and all the other little kids would see it, and how they'd wonder what the hell it meant, and then finally some dirty kid would tell them, all cockeyed naturally, what it meant, and how they'd all think about it, and maybe even worry about it for a couple of days. I kept wanting to kill whoever'd written it. I figured it was some perverty bum that had sneaked in the school late at night to take a leak or something, and then wrote it on the wall. I kept picturing myself catching him at it, and how I'd smash his head on the stone steps till he was good and goddamn dead and bloody. But I knew, too, I wouldn't have the guts to do it. I knew that. That made me even more depressed. I hardly even had the guts to rub it off the wall with my hand, if you want to know the truth. I was afraid some teacher would catch me rubbing it off and would think I'd written it.
But I rubbed it out anyway, finally. Then I went on up to the principal's office. The principal didn't seem to be around, but some old lady around 100 years old was sitting at a typewriter. I told her I was Phoebe Caulfield's brother in 4B1, and I asked her to please give Phoebe the note. I said it was very important because my mother was sick and wouldn't have lunch ready for Phoebe, and that she'd have to meet me and have lunch in a drugstore. She was very nice about it, the old lady. She took the note off me and called some other lady from the next office, and the other lady went to give it to Phoebe. Then the old lady that was around 100 years old and I shot the breeze for a while. She was pretty nice, and I told her how I'd gone there to school, too, and my brothers. She asked me where I went to school now, and I told her Pensy, and she said Pensy was a very good school. Even if I'd wanted to, I wouldn't have had the strength to straighten her out. Besides, if she thought Pensy was a very good school, let her think it. You hate to tell new stuff to somebody around 100 years old. They don't like to hear it. Then, after a while, I left. It was funny. She yelled good luck at me, the same way old Spencer did when I left Pensy. God, how I hate it when somebody yells good luck at me when I'm leaving somewhere. It's depressing. I went down by a different staircase, and I saw another fuck you on the wall. I tried to rub it off with my hand again, but this one was scratched on with a knife or something. It wouldn't come off. It's hopeless anyway. If you had 1,000,000 years to do it in, you couldn't rub out even half the fuck you signs in the world. It's impossible. I looked at the clock in the recess yard, and it was only 11:40, so I had quite a lot of time to kill before I met old Phoebe. But I just walked over to the museum anyway. There wasn't any place else to go. I thought maybe I might stop in a phone booth and give old Jane Gallagher a buzz before I started bumming my way west, but I wasn't in the mood. For one thing, I wasn't even sure she was home for vacation yet. So I just went over to the museum and hung around. While I was waiting around for Phoebe in the museum, right inside the doors and all, these two little kids came up to me and asked me if I knew where the mummies were. The one little kid, the one that asked me, had his pants open. I told him about it. So he buttoned them up right where he was standing, talking to me. He didn't even bother to go behind a post or anything. He killed me. I would have laughed, but I was afraid I'd feel like vomiting again, so I didn't. "Where are the mummies, fella?" the kid said again. "You know?" I horsed around with the two of them a little bit. "The mummies? What are they?" I asked the one kid. "You know, the mummies, them dead guys that get buried in them tombs and all." Tombs. That killed me. He meant tombs. "How come you two guys aren't in school?" I said. "No school today," the kid that did all the talking said. He was lying, sure as I'm alive, the little bastard. I didn't have anything to do, though, till old Phoebe showed up, so I helped them find the place where the mummies were. Boy, I used to know exactly where they were, but I hadn't been in that museum in years. "You two guys so interested in mummies?" I said.
"Yeah."
"Can't your friend talk?" I said.
"He ain't my friend. He's my brother."
"Can't he talk?" I looked at the one that wasn't doing any talking. "Can't you talk at all?" I asked him.
"Yeah," he said. "I don't feel like it."
Finally, we found the place where the mummies were, and we went in. "You know how the Egyptians buried their dead?" I asked the one kid.
"Nah."
"Well, you should. It's very interesting. They wrapped their faces up in these cloths that were treated with some secret chemical. That way they could be buried in their tombs for thousands of years, and their faces wouldn't rot or anything. Nobody knows how to do it except the Egyptians, even modern science." To get to where the mummies were, you had to go down this very narrow sort of hall with stones on the side that they'd taken right out of this pharaoh's tomb and all. It was pretty spooky, and you could tell the two hotshots I was with weren't enjoying it too much. They stuck close as hell to me, and the one that didn't talk at all practically was holding onto my sleeve.
"Let's go," he said to his brother. "I seen him already. Come on, hey."
He turned around and beat it.
"He's got a yellow streak a mile wide," the other one said. "So long."
He beat it, too. I was the only one left in the tomb then. I sort of liked it, in a way.
It was so nice and peaceful. Then, all of a sudden, you'd never guess what I saw on the wall. Another fuck you. It was written with a red crayon or something, right under the glass part of the wall, under the stones. That's the whole trouble. You can't ever find a place that's nice and peaceful because there isn't any. You may think there is, but once you get there, when you're not looking, somebody'll sneak up and write fuck you right under your nose. Try it sometime. I think even if I ever die and they stick me in a cemetery and I have a tombstone and all, it'll say Holden Caulfield on it, and then what year I was born and what year I died, and then right under that it'll say fuck you. I'm positive, in fact. After I came out of the place where the mummies were, I had to go to the bathroom. I sort of had diarrhea, if you want to know the truth. I didn't mind the diarrhea part too much, but something else happened. When I was coming out of the can, right before I got to the door, I sort of passed out. I was lucky, though. I mean, I could have killed myself when I hit the floor, but all I did was sort of land on my side. It was a funny thing, though. I felt better after I passed out. I really did. My arm sort of hurt from where I fell, but I didn't feel so damn dizzy anymore. It was about 10 after 12 or so then, and so I went back and stood by the door and waited for old Phoebe. I thought how it might be the last time I'd ever see her again. Any of my relatives, I mean. I figured I'd probably see them again, but not for years. I might come home when I was about 35, I figured, in case somebody got sick and wanted to see me before they died, but that would be the only reason I'd leave my cabin and come back. I even started picturing how it would be when I came back. I knew my mother'd get nervous as hell and start to cry and beg me to stay home and not go back to my cabin, but I'd go anyway. I'd be casual as hell. I'd make her calm down. And then I'd go over to the other side of the living room and take out the cigarette case and light a cigarette, cool as all hell. I'd ask them all to visit me sometime if they wanted to, but I wouldn't insist or anything. What I'd do, I'd let old Phoebe come out and visit me in the summertime and on Christmas vacation and Easter vacation. And I'd let D.B. come out and visit me for a while if he wanted a nice quiet place for his writing. But he couldn't write any movies in my cabin, only stories and books. I'd have this rule that nobody could do anything phony when they visited me. If anybody tried to do anything phony, they couldn't stay. All of a sudden, I looked at the clock in the check room, and it was 1:25. I began to get scared that maybe that old lady in the school had told that other lady not to give old Phoebe my message. I began to get scared that maybe she told her to burn it or something. It really scared hell out of me. I really wanted to see old Phoebe before I hit the road. I mean, I had her Christmas dough and all. Finally, I saw her. I saw her through the glass part of the door. The reason I saw her, she had my crazy hunting hat on. You could see that hat about 10 miles away. I went out the doors and started down these stone stairs to meet her. The thing I couldn't understand, she had this big suitcase with her. She was just coming across Fifth Avenue, and she was dragging this goddamn big suitcase with her. She could hardly drag it. When I got up closer, I saw it was my old suitcase, the one I used to use when I was at Wooten. I couldn't figure out what the hell she was doing with it. "Hi," she said, when she got up close. She was all out of breath from that crazy suitcase. "I thought maybe you weren't coming," I said. "What the hell's in that bag? I don't need anything. I'm just going the way I am. I'm not even taking the bags I got at the station. What the hell you got in there?" She put the suitcase down. "My clothes," she said. "I'm going with you. Can I? Okay?" "What?" I said. I almost fell over when she said that. I swear to God I did. I got sort of dizzy, and I thought I was going to pass out or something again. I took them down the back elevator so Charlene wouldn't see me. It isn't heavy. All I have in it is 2 dresses and my moccasins and my underwear and socks and some other things. Feel it. It isn't heavy. Feel it once. "Can I go with you, Holden? Can't I? Please?" "No, shut up." I thought I was going to pass out cold. I mean, I didn't mean to tell her to shut up and all, but I thought I was going to pass out again. "Why can't I? Please, Holden, I won't do anything. I'll just go with you, that's all.
I won't even take my clothes with me if you don't want me to. I'll just take my...
You can't take anything, because you're not going. I'm going alone, so shut up.
Please, Holden, please let me go. I'll be very, very, very... You won't even...
You're not going. Now shut up. Give me that bag, I said. I took the bag off her. I was almost all set to hit her. I thought I was going to smack her for a second. I really did. She started to cry.
I thought you were supposed to be in a play at school and all.
I thought you were supposed to be Benedict Arnold in that play and all, I said. I said it very nasty.
What do you want to do, not be in the play, for God's sake?
That made her cry even harder. I was glad. All of a sudden, I wanted her to cry till her eyes practically dropped out. I almost hated her. I think I hated her most because she wouldn't be in that play anymore if she went away with me. Come on, I said. I started up the steps to the museum again. I figured what I'd do was, I'd check the crazy suitcase she'd brought in the check room, and then she could get it again at 3 o'clock after school. I knew she couldn't take it back to school with her. Come on, now, I said. She didn't go up the steps with me, though. She wouldn't come with me. I went up anyway, though, and brought the bag in the check room and checked it, and then I came down again. She was still standing there on the sidewalk, but she turned her back on me when I came up to her. She can do that. She can turn her back on you when she feels like it. I'm not going away anywhere. I changed my mind, so stop crying and shut up, I said. The funny part was, she wasn't even crying when I said that. I said it anyway, though. Come on now. I'll walk you back to school. Come on now, you'll be late. She wouldn't answer me or anything. I sort of tried to get hold of her old hand, but she wouldn't let me. She kept turning around on me.
Did you have your lunch? You had your lunch yet? I asked her.
She wouldn't answer me. All she did was, she took off my red hunting hat, the one I gave her, and practically chucked it right in my face. Then she turned her back on me again. It nearly killed me, but I didn't say anything. I just picked it up and stuck it in my coat pocket. Come on, Hay, I'll walk you back to school, I said.
I'm not going back to school.
I didn't know what to say when she said that. I just stood there for a couple of minutes. You have to go back to school. You want to be in that play, don't you? You want to be Benedict Arnold, don't you?
No.
Sure you do. Certainly you do. Come on now, let's go, I said. In the first place, I'm not going away anywhere. I told you, I'm going home. I'm going home as soon as you go back to school. First, I'm going to go down to the station and get my bags, and then I'm going to go straight.
I said I'm not going back to school. You can do what you want to do, but I'm not going back to school, she said. So shut up.
It was the first time she ever told me to shut up. It sounded terrible. God, it sounded terrible. It sounded worse than swearing. She still wouldn't look at me either, and every time I sort of put my hand on her shoulder or something, she wouldn't let me. Listen, do you want to go for a walk? I asked her. Do you want to take a walk down to the zoo? If I let you not go back to school this afternoon and go for a walk, will you cut out this crazy stuff? She wouldn't answer me, so I said it over again. If I let you skip school this afternoon and go for a little walk, will you cut out the crazy stuff? Will you go back to school tomorrow like a good girl?
I may, and I may not, she said.
Then she ran right the hell across the street, without even looking to see if any cars were coming. She's a madman sometimes. I didn't follow her, though. I knew she'd follow me, so I started walking downtown toward the zoo, on the park side of the street, and she started walking downtown on the other goddamn side of the street. She wouldn't look over at me at all, but I could tell she was probably watching me out of the corner of her crazy eye to see where I was going and all. Anyway, we kept walking that way all the way to the zoo. The only thing that bothered me was when a double-decker bus came along, because then I couldn't see across the street, and I couldn't see where the hell she was. But when we got to the zoo, I yelled over to her, "Phoebe, I'm going in the zoo. Come on now." She wouldn't look at me, but I could tell she heard me, and when I started down the steps to the zoo, I turned around and saw she was crossing the street and following me and all. There weren't too many people in the zoo because it was sort of a lousy day,
but there were a few around the sea lion swimming pool and all. I started to go by it, but old Phoebe stopped and made out she was watching the sea lions getting fed. A guy was throwing fish at them, so I went back. I figured it was a good chance to catch up with her and all. I went up and sort of stood behind her and sort of put my hands on her shoulders, but she bent her knees and slid out from me. She can certainly be very snotty when she wants to. She kept standing there while the sea lions were getting fed, and I stood right behind her. I didn't put my hands on her shoulders again or anything, because if I had, she really would have beat it on me. Kids are funny. You have to watch what you're doing. She wouldn't walk right next to me when we left the sea lions, but she didn't walk too far away. She sort of walked on one side of the sidewalk, and I walked on the other side. It wasn't too gorgeous, but it was better than having her walk about a mile away from me like before. We went up and watched the bears on that little hill for a while, but there wasn't much to watch. Only one of the bears was out, the polar bear. The other one, the brown one, was in his goddamn cave and wouldn't come out. All you could see was his rear end. There was a little kid standing next to me with a cowboy hat on practically over his ears, and he kept telling his father, "Make him come out, Daddy, make him come out." I looked at old Phoebe, but she wouldn't laugh. You know kids when they're sore at you, they won't laugh or anything. After we left the bears, we left the zoo and crossed over this little street in the park, and then we went through one of those little tunnels that always smell from somebody's taking a leak. It was on the way to the carousel. Old Phoebe still wouldn't talk to me or anything, but she was sort of walking next to me now. I took a hold of the belt at the back of her coat just for the hell of it, but she wouldn't let me. She said, "Keep your hands to yourself if you don't mind." She was still sore at me, but not as sore as she was before. Anyway, we kept getting closer and closer to the carousel, and you could start to hear that nutty music it always plays. It was playing "Oh Marie." It played that same song about 50 years ago when I was a little kid. That's one nice thing about carousels. They always play the same songs. "I thought the carousel was closed in the winter time," old Phoebe said. It was the first time she practically said anything. She probably forgot she was supposed to be sore at me. "Maybe because it's around Christmas," I said. She didn't say anything when I said that. She probably remembered she was supposed to be sore at me. "Do you want to go for a ride on it?" I said. I knew she probably did. When she was a tiny little kid and Allie and D.B. and I used to go to the park with her, she was mad about the carousel. You couldn't get her off the goddamn thing. "I'm too big," she said. I thought she wasn't going to answer me, but she did. "No, you're not. Go on. I'll wait for you. Go on," I said. We were right there then. There were a few kids riding on it, mostly very little kids, and a few parents were waiting around outside, sitting on the benches and all. What I did was, I went up to the window, where they sell the tickets, and bought old Phoebe a ticket. Then I gave it to her. She was standing right next to me. "Here," I said. "Wait a second. Take the rest of your dough, too." I started giving her the rest of the dough she'd lent me. "You keep it. Keep it for me," she said. Then she said, right afterward, "Please." That's depressing, when somebody says please to you. I mean, if it's Phoebe or somebody, that depressed the hell out of me. But I put the dough back in my pocket. "Aren't you going to ride, too?" she asked me. She was looking at me sort of funny. You could tell she wasn't too sore at me anymore. "Maybe I will the next time. I'll watch you," I said. "Got your ticket?" "Yes." "Go ahead, then. I'll be on this bench right over here. I'll watch you." I went over and sat down on this bench, and she went and got on the carousel. She walked all around it. She walked once all the way around it. Then she sat down on this big, brown, beat-up-looking old horse. And the carousel started, and I watched her go around and around. There were only about 5 or 6 other kids on the ride, and the song the carousel was playing was "Smoke Gets in Your Eyes." It was playing it very jazzy and funny. All the kids kept trying to grab for the gold ring, and so was old Phoebe, and I was sort of afraid she'd fall off the goddamn horse, but I didn't say anything or do anything. The thing with kids is, If they want to grab for the gold ring, you have to let them do it, not say anything. If they fall off, they fall off. But it's bad if you say anything to them. When the ride was over, she got off her horse and came over to me. "You ride once, too, this time," she said. "No, I'll just watch you." "I think I'll just watch," I said. I gave her some more of her dough. "Here, get some more tickets." She took the dough off me. "I'm not mad at you anymore," she said. "I know. Hurry up. The thing's going to start again." Then, all of a sudden, she gave me a kiss. Then she held her hand out and said, "It's raining. It's starting to rain." "I know." Then what she did, and damn near killed me, she reached in my coat pocket and took out my red hunting hat and put it on my head. "Don't you want it?" I said. "You can wear it a while." "Okay. Hurry up, though, now. You're going to miss your ride. You won't get your own horse or anything." She kept hanging around, though. "Did you mean it, what you said? You really aren't going away anywhere? Are you really going home afterwards?" she asked me. "Yeah," I said. I meant it, too. I wasn't lying to her. I really did go home afterwards. "Hurry up now," I said. "The thing's starting." She ran and bought her ticket and got back on the goddamn carousel just in time. Then she walked all the way around it till she got her own horse back. Then she got on it. She waved to me, and I waved back. Boy, it began to rain like a bastard. In buckets, I swear to God. All the parents and mothers and everybody went over and stood right under the roof of the carousel so they wouldn't get soaked to the skin or anything. But I stuck around on the bench for quite a while. I got pretty soaking wet, especially my neck and my pants. My hunting hat really gave me quite a lot of protection in a way, but I got soaked anyway. I didn't care, though. I felt so damn happy all of a sudden, the way old Phoebe kept going around and around. I was damn near bawling. I felt so damn happy, if you want to know the truth. I don't know why. It was just that she looked so damn nice, the way she kept going around and around in her blue coat and all. God, I wish you could have been there. 26. That's all I'm going to tell about. I could probably tell you what I did after I went home, and how I got sick and all, and what school I'm supposed to go to next fall after I get out of here. But I don't feel like it. I really don't. That stuff doesn't interest me too much right now. A lot of people, especially this one psychoanalyst guy they have here, keeps asking me if I'm going to apply myself when I go back to school next September. It's such a stupid question, in my opinion. I mean, how do you know what you're going to do till you do it? The answer is, you don't. I think I am, but how do I know? I swear, it's a stupid question. DB isn't as bad as the rest of them, but he keeps asking me a lot of questions, too. He drove over last Saturday with this English babe that's in this new picture he's writing. She was pretty affected, but very good-looking. Anyway, one time, when she went to the ladies' room way the hell down in the other wing, D.B. asked me what I thought about all this stuff I just finished telling you about. I didn't know what the hell to say. If you want to know the truth, I don't know what I think about it. I'm sorry I told so many people about it. About all I know is I sort of miss everybody I told about, even old Stradlater and Ackley, for instance. I think I even miss that goddamn Maurice. It's funny. Don't ever tell anybody anything. If you do, you start missing everybody. 2. The Catcher in the Rye by J.D. Salinger. Read by Ray Hagen in the studios of the National Library Service for the Blind and Physically Handicapped for the Library of Congress, April 1999.